Welcome, welcome, welcome to this show, which has been going on since 2008. And you are now a guest on Paradigm Shifters because you are an amazing paradigm shifter on the planet. My guest is Lynn McTaggart. Lynn, you started off being a reporter, didn't you?
I sure did. And in my heart, I still am, Veronica. I'm still an investigative reporter. In my 20s, I was doing things like breaking baby selling rings and going undercover as an unwed mother to uncover these sorts of shady deals. So that was how I started out life. And I think
in your heart to find the truth, right?
Yeah. And to keep digging. There's a lot of good things about being a reporter. And one is, when I started out, it was a noble profession. And you felt like you were the fourth estate. And it was very important for you to really weigh up evidence to get to the truth. And it was only fair to the person you were writing about and only fair to your readers. So that kind of sense of responsibility in my research has never left me.
Oh, I love it. And you started off by setting up what we called, or is very familiar to everybody in the world now, the intention experiment, right? And wasn't that where you jumped in? I don't know that this is really true, but I think it's where you jumped in from being a reporter and into an investigative reporter that is literally shifting the paradigms of thought around the world, right? Really doing.
Well, I guess that was when I started doing things. I think the beginning of the shift for me was writing my book, The Field, which was the first book in this area. I've now written four books in the area of science and spirituality. But The Field really changed me. Because I was just curious about why things like homeopathy works and spiritual healing. You know, how can you have a thought and send it to someone else and then that person get better? You know, that seemed to violate everything we know about how our world works. Mm-hmm. So it was really in trying to determine why something like spiritual healing could work that I started interviewing these frontier scientists working in consciousness research. And I thought it was going to be easy just to, find out what they were doing, write it up, and that would be it. But it turned out to be this highly complex book that required two things: decoding these kinds of scientists, and physicists talk in code, they talk in math, and also putting it all together, because scientists who are doing experimental work don't like to speculate. No scientist likes to speculate. And they like to stick to their experimental evidence. And so I realized very shortly in starting to do the book that job of knitting it all together was going to be left to me. And so it was a daunting process. But in that process, I realized that all of these people were on the verge of discovering a completely new paradigm, a completely new view of the world, and that each of them had one little piece of it, of a puzzle that needed to be put together. So in doing that, it really changed my views about how the world works. And then I realized each time there was more unfinished business, and so the intention experiment was really just to, the impulse was, again, that investigative reporter. You know, so many people were talking about manifestation and, the secret and intention. And, the skeptic in me, the reporter in me, wanted to know, well, how far can we take this? You know, if our thoughts are things, which is what some of this experimental evidence seemed to suggest, that our thoughts are not only things, but things that affect other things. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, well, how far can we take this? You know, are we talking about a very subtle shift, like a quantum shift of a quantum particle? Are we talking about, the ability to halt a speeding train with a single gesture, or even cure cancer. What were we talking about here? So that's really why I started the intention experiment, to see how far we could take it. And also, what happens if loads of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does that magnify the effect?
So you used the scientific method, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, and I felt if we were going to look at this, we had to look at it through the lens of science. We had to actually prove it. There was plenty of woo-woo out there, but there was very little really demonstrating this was true with rigorous scientific method.
And didn't you have several labs around the world so that you could chronolog your results with the...
Yeah, I know it was really vital not to rely on the experimental evidence of just one lab, because we could be accused of experimental bias. So I enlisted many scientists working in consciousness research. People like Dr. Gary Schwartz, the noted psychologist at the University of Arizona, and his lab, and Dr. Rustam Roy, the late Rustam Roy, who is one of the world's experts on water from Penn State, Dr. Jessica Utz, one of the premier statisticians, professors of statistics in consciousness research from the University of California, Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, world-renowned physicist, working at St. Petersburg Technical University, and a real noted inventor of equipment that can measure the subtle light coming out of living systems, which is very highly affected by the power of thought. So all of these people and others were really helpful because they provided a different perspective and they could measure different things. So I wanted to try measuring very subtle things in the beginning, taking baby steps. So our first experiments were with seeds and leaves and things like that. And I didn't really think it was going to work, but it really worked. I mean, we've done 33 experiments to date, everything from the seed and leaf early experiments to purifying water, to lowering violence in war-torn and very violent areas, to healing someone of post-traumatic stress disorder. And of those 33 experiments, 29 have shown measurable, positive, mostly significant effects. You know, there is no pharmaceutical drug out there with that kind of consistent track record.
So it's kind of like a unifying common energy of thought that goes around the entire world. It's in us all, is it not?
Well, yeah, and there seems to be extraordinary things that happen when we do intention in small and large groups. And that was one of the interesting things that came out of the intention experiment. I expected the result to be magnified the more people you had. Mm-hmm. And that was not the case, because in a number of studies, we did the same experiment over and over with different size groups. So one of those experiments was a seed experiment where we worked with the University of Arizona on this one, their team. And they put together four sets of 30 seeds each, seeds A, B, C, and D. They would send us photos of the seeds. Whenever I was speaking in front of a group of varying sizes, so for instance, the first one was in Sydney, Australia, we would randomly, the audience and I, choose one of those four sets of seeds. The scientists wouldn't know which ones we chose. We'd set intention and send it to one of the sets of seeds. I'd tell the scientists we were done, still not telling them which seeds we sent intention to. They would plant the seeds and then measure them 5 days later to see if the seeds we sent intention to grew higher than the controls, because that was our intention. That's what we sent, mm-hmm. that they would grow a specific height by a certain day. And after when they were finished measuring, they would tell us, and we would then unblind the study and tell them which seeds we sent intention to. And every single time we did it, we ran it 6 times, the seeds sent intention grew significantly higher than the controls.
Wow.
Now, sometimes We had groups of 700, sometimes groups of several thousand when I was doing it over the internet, and sometimes just a group of 100. And it didn't matter. The size of group did not matter. All it seemed to need was a group of any size.
Wow. Well, now, so, and you've moved on to a lot of health situations that were very dire, but I want to jump ahead one little bit here. Something I talked to you many years ago, and in the intention experiment, people healed people with intention from a different time. Do you remember that? It was, I think, in Israel. Or there was a hospital or something, and way back.
Oh, yeah. This is an interesting thing about quantum physics and the power of intention. We think of time as this forward-going arrow, you know, that goes in only one direction, and that cause has to precede effect always. I mean, that's what we're taught. That's a real basic mm-hmm. in our understanding of how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really fascinating to look at some of the experimental evidence. So in this particular case that you're talking about, there was an Israeli professor called Leonard Levovici, who was a big skeptic and wanted to demonstrate that you couldn't use the scientific method to study alternative medicine. So he devised a study of patients with blood sepsis, which is a very, you know, life-threatening condition, blood infection.
Mm-hmm.
And he divided them into two groups. And one group got conventional treatment, and the other group got conventional treatment plus prayer. Now, he was pretty convinced that this would demonstrate, you know, that no effect. But after he calculated the results, he was kind of shocked to find that the patients who received prayer were better in every regard. They were healthier, they had fewer side effects, they got out of the hospital faster, fewer casualties. But there was really an interesting coda to the study. The prayer was and the study was carried out in the year 2000. The patients had been in the hospital in the years 1992 to 1994, 6 to 8 years earlier. So what he had done is simply take hospital records, randomly put them into two piles, have prayer sent to one of the piles of people. But to his dismay, those people were healthier in every regard, even though they'd already left the hospital. It actually had somehow gone back in time and affected them. So he wrote this up, published it in The Lancet, and assumed this would demonstrate once and for all you can't use the scientific method to study alternative medicine. That's not how it was interpreted. The way it was interpreted is that we can go back and change the past.
I love that. I've thought about that for years. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's very interesting, too, because when you look at it, it's the evidence shows not just this study, but many studies in consciousness research showing that intention can easily violate time. And I certainly have found this because one of the things I teach is healing your past through intention. Mm-hmm. And it is the methods work very just as well as they do when you're dealing with things in the present. Mm-hmm. But with the science, which backs this up, there's so many studies showing that studies of things that happen in present time that have been effective, like Princeton University's work with random event generators, which are those 20th century versions of a toss of a coin, a computerized program that randomly, let's say, shows cowboys on a computer screen sometimes, and Indians sometimes, through a random process. So because it's random, it shows cowboys about 50% of the time and Indians about 50% of the time. But what they did at Princeton was to have an operator sitting in front of the computer, and they used loads and loads, hundreds of operators. And they would ask them to set an intention to have more Indians than cowboys, say. And they found, after doing hundreds of thousands of these trials, that there was a small but significant trend toward whatever intention the person had. So whether it was cowboys or they wanted more Indians, you know, they ended up getting in the main what they wanted. So they found that that kind of study works actually even better when it's out of time, when they've had the computer system already running, believe it or not, you know, that's already run, then they have somebody set an intention, and they found it works even better.
Oh my gosh.
I know, even studies of remote viewing, that ability of someone to see and describe a physical part of the world or some aspect of the world that they cannot see with their own senses. They have done many, many studies at Princeton and at Stanford Research Institute where they would have a person sitting in a lab who was the remote viewer. And then he'd have a traveling partner. The scientist would give the traveling partner an envelope containing one of a random number of destinations. And that's where the traveling partner would have to go to. Sometimes it was 3,000 miles away. Sometimes it was around the corner and everything in between. And when he got there, the remote viewer, who did not know where his partner was going, would have to draw and describe where he was. And they demonstrated that, you know, in a significant number of cases, just ordinary people could get that right a percentage of the time. And gifted remote viewers could get that right an enormous percentage of the time. But here's the other interesting part of it. They ran a thing called precognitive remote viewing, where they would have the remote viewer draw and describe where his partner was going before his partner selected the envelope, before he even went. And those were hugely significant. They found breathtaking examples of this, where the partner went to Russia, for instance, and went to one of the Russian Orthodox cathedrals, and his partner drew something that had all of the architectural peculiarities of that building and drew exactly where his partner was going. Another one went to a train station in Glencoe, Illinois, and the partner, the remote viewer, drew him inside a train station and described a train station, and so many others. It was just extraordinary.
Wow, isn't that exciting? Now, I'm going to shift just a little bit, not to change the subject, but this is kind of an elongation of something. You've done a lot of experiments and talked to a lot of scientists about, for example, our common bond, which is the field, right? And there were some descriptions by a fellow named Pop, I think, talking about this fine little light. This isn't a change of subject, but it seems like it in a way. But a fine little light that we that everything living emanates. Is that right? And that,
yeah,
that there's a unity in that. Is there a factor of communication in that?
There's a factor of communication in that. It's called biophoton emissions. The late Fritz Albert Popp, a German physicist, discovered this. He found that human beings and actually all living things emit a tiny current of light. And this light is not only a communication system within our own bodies, because it's emanating from DNA, and it seems to be a communication system, a kind of global communication system in the body. So if you, for instance, put some sort of medication, like a medicating cream, on one hand, it will change the light there, but it will also change the light in every other part of your body. So
that's remarkable.
There seems to be this incredible communication system, but it's also a communication system outside your body. He's found that living things have a kind of synchronicitous communication system. When you're sending light out, you get a response from another living system and you send responses back. So you're having, in a sense, a conversation in light.
Hmm.
And he's found that with all living things, from, you know, fleas to human beings. So the interesting thing is this light gets very much changed by the power of intention.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Schwartz, again.
Well, wait a minute. I'm thinking it is part of the, it is the intention, is it not?
Well, it is possibly a vehicle of intention.
Or the communicator.
I think it's mm-hmm. it's the communication medium for, in intention, or at least it seems to be. For instance, when healers are sending healing, so they're setting an intention to heal something, the University of Arizona, using Dr. Korotkov, Konstantin Korotkov, the Russian physicist's equipment, which also is a method of measuring this light, when they've measured it using special cameras with healers, when they were sending healing, the light massively increased from their dominant hand. And other energy has massively increased from their dominant hand. So I think it is a medium for intention.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really exciting. I was thinking how when we were talking about time and things changing back in time, you've already just discussed, and I'm going, we often think as time is that bond that we all have, but it's not so, is it? Do you know what I mean? It's an intentional expectation in the mind. Would you say that?
Yeah, I think it is a construct, a human construct. I mean, no quantum physicist these days believes that time is a forward-going arrow. They believe time is much more like one big smeared out now. And certainly the evidence shows that. I mean, the scientist from the Institute of Noetic Sciences, their chief scientist, Dr. Dean Radin, did a very interesting series of studies using a computerized process that was like a two-step process. And he found something really interesting. So it was step A and then step B in order to finish the process. But he found, and listen to this, the speed at which you did step B, the second step, influenced the speed at which you did step A. So the latter step influenced the speed of the former step.
Oh, my.
So I know, so hard to get your mind around. So
I do. I love it. Don't you? It kind of dishevels some of these rigidities that we have, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And the way he describes it and the way we can understand it is that it's not like the present affects the past and changes the past, but the future affects the present as it's unfolding.
Wow.
The future affects the present as it's unfolding. You know, I spoke to the late Robert John. He was one of the heroes in my book, The Field, from the Dean of Engineering from the University of Princeton, who did all those remote viewing studies and those random event generator studies. He organized the whole thing. And I said, how can this be, this whole thing of violating causality and time? And he said, simple, Lynn. Take time out of it. It all makes sense. And I think that's it. Take time, our notion of time, out of it, and it all makes sense.
Well, it's sort of like how we file our thoughts in many ways, isn't it? You got to move the filing cabinet around.
I think that's an absolutely great way of putting it. Absolutely. You have to think in a different way. And that's certainly the case with the Power of Eight groups that I do and the Power of Eight and intention work that I teach, is I see that we can violate that. We can go back all the time and do intentions for things that have already happened and change what happens going forward.
Love that. And you're doing lots of tests on that. And I'm going to jump very fast into the subject that we are all lingering around these days or worrying around, which is the coronavirus. and I'm wanting to jump in and say, could we have changed it by intending its past that it didn't happen? You are doing wonderful intentions with the coronavirus. Anyway, I'd like you to talk about that whole pandemic and the whole global. The other thing is the consciousness of a global focus. You know, what is that doing with us? I'm just kind of, you talk.
Those are all such great questions, Veronica. Number one, can we bring back the dead? No. I don't think we can. I certainly haven't seen it yet. So the number of people who have died in the world, I think, are dead. You know, they are passed. Could we have gone back and changed this whole thing? Well, that's assuming that it was bad for humanity. We should stop it. And I want to look at
that's a good point.
You know, it was very sad and tragic for the people who have died. And I think that our leaders could have, you know, they didn't have much information, but certainly I know we could have handled it better where I live in the UK, had there been much greater care for protective equipment and in places like nursing homes and hospitals, we would not have lost anywhere near as many people as we did. And many other things that don't have to do with intention, but have to do with acknowledging things already that are showing promise, such as intravenous vitamin C, which is being trialed, you know, a number of places with extremely encouraging results, including in China, by teams of doctors from the West too, who are doing this, and that should have been introduced. Ionizers are demonstrated to kill viruses. That should have been introduced in hospitals and places and nursing homes. Loads of things like that. But putting all of that aside and the tragic death rate.
Well, but wait a minute. I want to also throw in this other question is, do you think that we're just trying to scour a population that is kind of overdoing itself?
Well, no, I don't think that's the case.
Okay, you don't think it's intentional then? Yes.
No, I don't think we're doing this. I don't see any of it. Remember, Veronica, I'm quite a conservative journalist. If I can find evidence of outrageous things, I certainly am not shy about saying it. And there's certainly plenty of things to say. But in terms of is this one big vast conspiracy set up? No, there doesn't seem to be. There seems to be more and more evidence that it was some sort of mistake in a Chinese lab. That's as much as we've got right now that seems to be to have a fair amount of evidence. But was this set off as a conspiracy to eliminate lots of people and to put us under house arrest? I don't think so. Okay. I think it's more the case that governments don't know what they're doing. I think that there certainly are questions about some of the political maneuvering around vaccination. That I will allow, as there is oftentimes, and corruption around it, as there is plenty of times. But let's get back to the whole idea of intention, and also something that I'm really interested in, which is I and many other people in these kind of consciousness movements have been talking about the fact that we feel that, you know, humanity needs to and is going through a massive shift. I mean, that certainly was the talk back in around 2011, 2012. You know, we were about to go through this big shift. We'd have this huge financial meltdown in 2008 and 9. And many people said, well, capitalism as we know it is going down. The world as we know it is going down. In fact, in 2012, as the buy-in long count calendar predicted, this is going to be the beginning of the end of the world. Well, that didn't happen. You know, as far as I can see, you know, lots of people talked about how we were automatically evolving. I saw no evidence of that. What I saw was that the banks got bailed out. Everything went back to normal after a while, and we all went back to sleep. And so nothing much changed. Certainly nothing in the world we had really changed. So
that was disappointing, actually, wasn't it, for a lot of
us?
Yeah,
we all thought, oh, big shift. But, you know, it has to be a conscious shift. It can't be, it's not something that's happening naturally, automatically. I think that's the big mistake, to think of that. You know, we have been so conditioned to be in a world of seeming scarcity, of the whole Darwinian idea of eat or be eaten. You know, I win, you lose. So we're all in that kind of competitive and isolated and separatist mindset. So changing that means really we have to change massively. So here we have this giant virus, this invisible enemy that flattens us, that we don't know how to deal with, that is required the most drastic kind of shutdown of society as we know it, because nobody knows how to deal with this. And so I can speak for where we are in the UK. We are in week, I think it is 8 of lockdown, and they're only going to very slowly ease it over the next weeks. So it's going to take months to completely ease it. Now, lots of people are looking at things very, very differently. I'm seeing a big value change, so that the heroes of the hour aren't the richest people in the world, like the celebrities, etc. They are being, you know, many of them are being sort of scorned for being, you know, kind of snowflakes in this whole crisis. And some of the real heroes are the people who are on the front line, the nurses, the doctors, who, you know, are in most cases dealing without even protective equipment, the bus drivers and train drivers who are still working when they're exposed to a lot of this virus.
Even the grocery stores, yeah.
Exactly, the grocery store workers, et cetera, the people who are way down on the economic scale are the heroes. And here we have in the UK, the biggest hero we've had recently was a 99-year-old man called Captain Tom Moore, who looked at the plight of the NHS. You've probably heard about this.
I did. I love it.
And said, what can I do? And he'd fallen down, broken his hip. So he had a hip replacement. He was walking with a walker. So he said, well, maybe I can get people to sponsor me and I could raise £100 for it, for the NHS, for the National Health Service. So he walks up and down his backyard 100 times because he's due to be 100 at the end of April. Well, he doesn't raise £100. He doesn't raise £1,000. He raises 32 million and he becomes the biggest national hero. He is, you know, he records a song with a singer called Michael Ball, with the backing of the NHS Caring Choir. And that goes to number one. All of those proceeds are going to the NHS. He has raised more money pretty much than anybody else. He's probably going to get a knighthood. He had, you know, Spitfires, the old World War II planes, flying over his house on his 100th birthday. Talks from the, you know, messages from the Queen and the Prime Minister, et cetera, et cetera. And he is the nation's darling right now. This little old guy who said, what can I do? So I'm looking at all of this as a really interesting value change and saying, wow, maybe this is going to set up a much more connected and communal society. People are talking all the time, with all of the inconveniences we have, that people have time now to be nice to each other. People have time to help each other. People are helping each other in all kinds of amazing ways. We don't hear that. We hear about the body counts every day. And then terrible things going on.
And the isolation. People have to stay apart, so they can't help each other the same way, right?
Well, they are in different ways. I mean, one of the things I've been encouraging, as you know, besides the intention experiment, I run these things called Power of Eight groups. And I wrote a book called The Power of Eight. It's my latest book, which is about the power of small groups. not only to heal other people, but to heal the centers too. And how it is this amazing virtual circle where there's a kind of mirror effect in giving and getting intention. And what's been so interesting is that this is a lifeline many people find during these times. We are, you know, we're so interested. We are encouraging people to organize Power of Eight groups. I've got a Facebook page called Connecting and Feeling, Connecting and Healing Through the Power of Eight. It's a Facebook group anybody can join. And it's for people to just advertise if they need a Power of Eight group. You know, just advertise their where they are in their time zone. Just put up a little notice. I'd love to create a Power of Eight group. I'm in New Zealand, or I'm in London, or I'm in New York, or I'm in California, whatever, whatever your time zone. And we have, you know, thousands of people joining up. So,
the Power of Eight groups to focus intention on the coronavirus dissipating?
No, each other. Each other.
Okay.
Each other. I mean, it's, you know, we're doing big intention experiments for the coronavirus. I do that every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern, 5 p.m. UK, 6 p.m. Europe, on my live Facebook page, Lynn McTaggart 2011. And we've, you know, we've been doing intention to flatten the curve, but I've also been doing intention to lower fear in people's minds, to have them help imagine a different kind of world. Because it is going to be different when we come out of this. At least I hope it is.
Oh, I feel like it has to be. We've learned too much, right?
I think we have. I think we have. I mean, I think there's, you know, going to be such a huge way to go. But as I said before, I think it's very interesting, the value change. People are starting to see that stuff doesn't matter so much as connection. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that people have been starved of, as you said, with this isolation, is connection more than anything else. So with our Power of Eight groups, I mean, we're encouraging people to meet virtually, because it works just as well when you're trying to heal someone or heal fear or feel together or whatever. It works just as well when you're meeting on Skype as it or Zoom as it does when you're meeting in person. The other thing to say about coronavirus, too, I should mention is, you know, we also got frustrated. The other side of me is the magazine editor of a magazine called What Doctors Don't Tell You and an organization called Get Well, which holds exhibitions and webinars and webcasts about helping people with chronic conditions get well, or just helping people stay well. And one of the things we did was a four-part webinar, free to everybody, called Supercharge Yourself Against Coronavirus. And we had interviews, a four-part series, interviews with a number of top integrative specialists, doctors, talking about which vitamins, what recipe of vitamins and supplements and food can best protect you against any kinds of bad effects of the coronavirus. Also, what do you do if you first get it? Now, I'm not saying don't go to your doctor, but there's measures you can take at the first sign of it, like very high-dose vitamin C and using iodine externally, just inhaling it, for instance, in a few drops in a salt pipe. There's a very good doctor here, one of the top specialists in a number of things, including chronic fatigue, who has used that kind of inhalation of iodine for years against the nastiest kinds of flus.
And it has to be Lugol iodine, is that right?
It has to be Lugol's iodine, and it's just a few drops, three or four drops in a salt pipe. I mean, we have the interview with the doctor who does that, Dr. Sarah Myhill, and we talked with Dr. Damien Downing, who is one of a number of scientists who has worked together with doctors trialing intravenous vitamin C on critically ill COVID-19 patients. And in one study of 50 patients, no one died.
Wow.
They all survived.
Wow.
And we had also Jeannie Driscoll, who is one of two doctors in the U.S. licensed to study intravenous vitamin C, also studying big studies of it and finding it's effective. In lower doses, it can help prevent or mitigate the effects of COVID-19 too. So we had that, and we also had people on showing certain small, easy exercises that actually boost your immune system, which is key with coronavirus, and the things you can do to stop the kind of fear and the stress response we're all feeling, and to create a relaxation response, certain tapping techniques, certain meditation techniques, and also Power of Eight techniques. So if any of your listeners are interested and want that information, it's free. There's no upsell. They just need to go to getwell.solutions and just sign up for it. And we've got downloads with the recipes and all of those things that people can just have.
Get Well. I'm looking forward to going into that myself. Tell me about the Power of Eight. Is it? Did you choose the number because eight is such a powerful foundational number?
Great question, Veronica. No, it was just an accident.
Are there any accidents, Lynn?
I know. It was just an accident. I was trying to figure out how to shrink down the intention experiments to a workshop. And I wasn't really sure how to do this. I hadn't done it before. And so I was kicking around with my husband one night. And I said to him, this is back in 2008. And I said to him, I don't know, maybe I'll just put people in groups of eight or so and have them set an intention to some member of the group with a health challenge. And he kind of pointed the finger at me and said, yeah, I love it, the power of eight. Now, that was how it started, by complete accident. We didn't think it was going to be anything more than a little feel-good effect, like getting a massage. So we did it with the first workshop we ran, which was a group in Chicago. We put people in groups of eight or so. We had them set intention to a member of the group with a health challenge. And we had them come back the next day and report on their outcomes. And we expected, as I say, it to feel like somebody had just had a facial or something, just a little relaxation. Mm-hmm. That's not what happened. We had a woman with cataracts say she was 80% better. We had a woman who was walking badly and said she, you know, she had terrible knee arthritis. And she said she was walking normally that day. Somebody else with migraines, chronic migraines, who said that they were healed that day, that she was free of migraines. Somebody else with awful digestive problems said he felt normal, and just on and on it went. So we were kind of shocked by that and disbelieving. I thought, oh, well, this is just a placebo effect. You know, the journalist in me, the skeptic, was coming to the fore. But the more we did this, and I've worked with thousands of groups by now over the years, the more we saw in every single situation and setting, even if I was putting people into groups after doing a keynote speech in front of, you know, 1,200 people, every time we did this, there were people in the groups who had amazing, extraordinary healings. Last summer, we had a situation where I was speaking in front of a conference. And I put people into groups at the end, as I often do, and had them set intention for a member of the group with a health challenge. Well, one of the women, Maya, was a young woman who had suddenly got paralyzed from the neck down. It was some sort of idiopathic paralysis. Doctors didn't understand it. And it was tragic because she is a dancer. So her group decided she should be the person, the recipient. So they set an intention for her. And then after this, as I always do when I've run these types of groups, I ask anybody in the audience to have an experience they want to share. So the whole group said, oh, you must talk to the Maya. And she talked about how she felt like during the experience, this extreme feeling like her wheelchair was dropping off of her.
Because
she was
wow.
there for me.
Wow.
And she all of a sudden, and I said, well, tell us all about it. And she gets up and she stands up. And she looks around the audience. Now, we all were blown away and there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. And I have to say that was probably one of the more extreme ones, but it certainly isn't the only one. I mean, I had one other situation where a recent one where, I had a woman due for a knee replacement right after the 10-minute intention we did. And that's all I do, 10 minutes. She was able to do a deep squat with her knees.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, a woman who came in with a dislocated shoulder, and during her intention, it slotted back into place. Woman who couldn't focus her eyes after a stroke, and she focused them perfectly after this intention. And, on and on and on it went. Even people who are skeptics find that it works for them. So it's extraordinary to me. So the point is, too, about eight, it doesn't have to be eight. It can be five. It can be 12. Eight was, as I say, it came about by accident. Even with all of its meaning, its meanings as the favorite number of the Chinese, and he's got so much meaning as a sideways infinity sign and in sacred geometry. What I found is it's kind of like a Goldilocks figure. It's not too little, it's not too big. It's kind of ideal, but it's not necessary.
Okay.
All you need is a small group. I think a group of three is too small. I think a group of 20 starts getting too big.
Mm-hmm.
So it just needs to be somewhere in between. And maybe eight is ideal.
And regular. You mean you have to get together often?
Yeah, I think you should meet at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly when I teach year-long master classes, I have the people meeting once a week.
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of trains that, I'm going back to that light that's coming off of the photonic, what did you call it? The
biophotonic emissions.
Yeah.
Well,
is it like training it to be in unit, like to be one with all? You know what I'm saying?
I think, yeah, I don't think we can strictly say, yes, it's training the light. What we are is training consciousness to be as one.
Mm-hmm.
Your consciousness, you operate, you walk around as though you have a separate consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a feeling of separation. But what we did find, remember, I always like to stick to the science.
Sure,
what
I
we
like
found
that.
The power of eight groups when we did studies of them with noted neuroscientists from Life University, which is the largest chiropractic university in the world. We did a series of experiments putting an EEG cap on one member of seven, each in seven power of eight groups. This was among student volunteers who had never done it before. And they found that each time and they were all senders of intention, very shortly into working as a little power of eight group, the parts of the brain involved with separation started lowering drastically.
Mm.
So the activity in that part of the brain lowered drastically. So particularly the parietal lobes, which are two parts of the brain toward the back of the top of the head, and they help us navigate through space and to determine what's me and what's not me, and they were turned way down, and so were the frontal lobes in the right frontal lobes that are involved with things like worry, doubt, negativity. They were dialed way down too. So these were people in a state of ecstatic oneness.
Wow.
And I think that's the point. We're moving beyond this sense of separation that we operate in and experiencing for ourselves that oneness of consciousness. That's not something we get to do very much.
Maybe this is the shift.
Well, this is the way the shift will happen, I think, is really connecting as one. And certainly we see individual shifts. You know, that's the place where miracles of healing happen. It's the place where people are physically healed, where they change in their lives, where they get new careers. I mean, this is what I find all the time with our Power of Eight groups. When people meet regularly, not just their health, but loads of other things in their life begin to shift when other people are intending for them. And one of the great things about Power of Eight groups is that there's the major aspect of it is altruism, because you are never intending for yourself. If you're a recipient, you're just receiving. But when you're most of the time, you're intending for someone else. So each person, you know, gets a chance at being the subject, but a lot of the time, most of the time, they are doing intending for someone else. And it is that seems to be really responsible for the shifts. People, when they get off of themselves, amazing things happen. When you look at the science of altruism, it's extraordinary. You know, people who do things for other people are healthier, happier, and live longer in every regard.
Wow.
So I think that's the power. We've been living by a scientific story that makes us lonely and selfish people in a lonely universe, in a lonely and selfish, you know, on a lonely and selfish planet. And a Power of Eight group is just a tiny microcosm of what could be a connected, unified group working all together for other people.
I love this. But Lynn McTaggart, you are so inspiring, and I'm so grateful for your work through the years. And thank you for spending time on Paradigm Shifters with us. Thank you so much.
And it's been my pleasure, Veronica, as always.
All right. Thanks again. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening, and the podcast will be up next week. Thank you.